KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Our top priority must be to do everything we can to grow the economy and create good middle-class jobs. That's our top priority. That's our North Star.
In the midst of a very difficult period, with the spotlight on policing unlike any in recent decades, they've continued to bring down our crime rate.
I don't have a county phone, I don't have a county laptop, I don't have a county credit card.
That was Dow Constein talking about King County and a Parks ballot that's coming up in King County later. Mayor McGinn from his State of the City speech on Seattle Police Department, and President Obama talking about the sequester all happening this week, which we will take a look back at with Joni Balter of the Seattle Times, Eli Sanders, Associate Editor of The Stranger, and Knute Berger, Editor-at-Large of Seattle Magazine and writer of the Mossback column at crosscut.com. Good to see you all again.
Good to see you, Steve.
Nice to be here.
I'll be doing less speaking and you'll be doing more since nobody
That's
wants to
That's because that scarf's too tight.
Yeah. I have a very nice scarf on that my colleague Karen Turner made for me. It's very beautiful.
You got to take care of those vocal cords.
Yeah. In this case, we'll just not subject people to the scratchiness. I was wondering how y'all looked at what happened with Aaron Reardon, the Snohomish County executive, and his resignation following some reporting by the Herald, by the Times, looking at the aftermath of other complaints that were made against Aaron Reardon. He's had a contentious relationship with the other members of the county government there. But I want to ask you a question in terms of something Dow Constantine said when I asked him this yesterday, which is what he said. This was as far as he was going in anything criticism. He said, you know, we've learned at the county here that it's better to keep our anger focused on the issues rather than on personalities. And given that, what did you make of the story of what's erupted with Aaron Reardon and the Snohomish County Council?
Well, one thing for Dow Constantine, who was the member of the council first before becoming the county executive, you know, the county council did at one time have 13 members, and that seemed to be a big number, and there was a lot of, quarreling, shall we say. But if you look at the Snohomish County situation, the heat was turning up every day, it seems like, for Aaron Reardon up there. The day before, he said that he was going to step down effective May 31. The council stripped him of direct control of this committee, that some kind of an information and technology committee. And that, you know, sort of every day, and the Democratic Party, the state one, was talking about how do we replace him. So the heat was just getting turned up, and he referenced that in his surprise remarks. He was giving other comments when he surprised everyone and said that he would step down in May.
State of the county.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, state of the county, and everyone went there to hear, you know, the sort of, you know, how chirpy things are in Snohomish County, or what the problems were, something like that. But at the very end, he pipes in and says, by the way, here I go. And what he referenced was how hard the allegations against him that have been looked at a couple times have been on him, his family. And just that he basically is saying the pressure was just getting to be too much.
Enough is enough, he said. He was quoted, he said he's been the focus of, quote, false and scurrilous accusations. And he said it's, quote, part of a concerted effort by groups that oppose his work, end quote. And he was investigated by the Washington State Patrol, but never charged for allegations of misusing county money during an extramarital affair, which he admitted occurred. He's also the focus of a state public disclosure campaign investigation about using county resources on political campaigns. There's been a Gold Bar blogger who's been leading this effort to get him recalled from office. And then on top of that, there was this question that was just raised about whether there was a retaliation using county resources against the people that opposed him, right?
Right, yeah. He had people that worked for him and were associated with him. Everett Herald traced the guys who were basically supporting Reardon online, but they were also using the public disclosure requests and whatnot to harass his political enemies. And it turns out they were able to trace this back the paper was reporting, trace it back to Reardon's own people. And I think that created, you know, an additional climate of just mistrust. I mean, it's just one sort of story after another, all of it relating to, a basic kind of honesty. I mean, the fact that he was having an affair and there was a, state patrol investigation looking into whether he was using county resources, which apparently he wasn't except for one possible questionable deal. But
don't have affairs when you're in public office.
Well, I think it just it's that kind of thing where you get to the point where it's just kind of cascading. It's just one thing after another, and retaliating against the people who go after you ends up being kind of yet another scandal. It just was getting really toxic up there.
You know, a lot of people have affairs in public office and not. I think the issue here was misuse of county resources and then the potential allegations of the cover-up and the retaliation. But the bigger issue, it seemed to me, was this just did not end. How old is this story?
It feels like
3 years, maybe?
Don't
you remember it sort of broke right as the election was happening?
Right.
And so the vote, it was almost like the vote had already come in. And so he was running for re-election, and he had a real challenger. But the way the story came out, at the possible pieces of the story came out as the voters were voting.
But Reardon says it's been happening since before his re-election in 2011. So he says it's been sort of this.
Yes, but what I'm saying is it's almost like as soon as he sat in that seat for the new term, this was hanging over him, and this was unfolding as this was happening.
Oh, I was just going to say one of the pieces of the story that certainly people in Snohomish County at one time and the Democratic Party, Reardon was one of those names that some years ago, started coming up as a potential for running for governor, running for senator. He was a Democratic leader, kind of on the rise. He was popular. He was charismatic. People felt that he had certain, and so it's sort of a big fall from that. I think a lot of people, the expectations were raised, and so the disappointment, I think, is also part of that. They people just really expected sort of better.
So KUW's Amy Radel did a story on it, and in the end, she quoted a council member. Thinking back to the calmer days of Bob Drewell when he was Snohomish County executive, Snohomish County has Everett, it's got Edmonds, it's got growth galore going on, especially on the east side of I-5, where a lot of new development is taking place. Snohomish and Pierce are where a lot of development is going to be happening in the next decade. I mean, what does that tell us about the kind of governance they have now or the people or what we might expect in the future?
Well, don't forget, it's a Democratic-controlled council. Normally a Democratic county executive would be doing just fine there. The talk that Skip was referring to is, county executive positions, for some reason, is a great stepping stone for politicians. So you have
it's worked well for Ron Sims.
It worked well for Gary Locke, is who
yes,
it worked
it
well
did.
For.
It
yeah,
did.
John Spellman.
Right. And so county
Who's
executive
Gardner?
Is one of those stepping stone positions. You'll notice that mayors rarely are. But, Pierce County Executive, former Pierce County Executive Booth Gardner. And so Skip is referring to the fact that when this sort of golden boy, Aaron Reardon, elected a very young age to the state legislature and just kind of zooming politically, they put the name out there and said that wouldn't that be perfect from somebody. I think Snohomish County many years is the fastest growing county in the state. And so sort of a modern new county executive who's never made a mistake. You know, he's going places, but then
And one reason I think that phenomenon exists is because the particularly the counties like Pierce, Snohomish, and King County kind of represent the state in the sense of they're being divided into these blue and red east-west segments. So they're sort of the state in miniature, and if you can successfully manage a county, and plus one of the uniting factors in these counties is development and business. And so you get guys in there who are a pro-business, but they can deal both with the kind of conservative and Democratic elements, and it suggests that maybe they can do that statewide.
But this doesn't seem to have been like a Republican conspiracy to kneecap a Democrat who is, you know, who could play to both those constituencies and might be governor someday. This is a story of self-inflicted wounds largely, which suggests that he wasn't, that maybe his meteoric rise was not as deserved as it first seemed.
I enjoy the image of the kneecapping.
A little shout out to Tanya Harding.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh,
right.
Yeah. Let's not forget her.
Oh, my. All right. Let me ask you.
I have forgotten her.
Me too. Let me ask you about the sequester talk and what's happening and your sense of it. And let me read you this. This was from Matt Miller, a Democrat, a Center for American Progress. He's a co-host left, right, and center on KUOW. He said that. He was listening to President Obama talk about the sequester. And in rapid succession, we heard the president say that 5% cuts in so-called domestic discretionary spending, roughly 7% in defense, would impose hardships that were brutal, akin to being hacked with a meat cleaver, eviscerate all we hold dear. What do you think about that?
Well, I thought I liked the piece because I thought that he had quite a jolly time making fun of people who think of 5% cut is a big deal, because companies and governments that have been through much bigger percentage cuts have not invoked such Armageddon, would you do, for plural?
I do not know, but I think somebody should tell us what's the plural of Armageddon. I would just say Armageddons, but... Yeah.
You never know. I got to go back to that their Latin or Greek class.
Armageddon. I like that. You may have just come up with a new and novel phrase.
Whatever it was Armageddon plural. That's what I was trying to get to.
Well, he made the argument that you should make a macroeconomic argument, that it's a mistake to cut government right now at this heavily because of the fact what we've seen about unemployment issues and about what government can do when the economy is not spending, when we are not spending, our companies are not spending. But The sequester seems to be moving ahead because the Tea Party in the House seem to want it. So what would be a better response, do you think, Knut?
Well, it depends on, I mean, you know, it's interesting to watch how many liberals are kind of coming to like the sequester also.
They like that 7% defense cut.
Yeah, I mean, they look at the defense cuts, and there is a a thing which is, look, this isn't ideal. It's not what we would do if we were in charge. But let's make lemonade out of the lemon in some way. Maybe there's a way that I think the argument that Obama is making, you know, which is what the potential effect to the larger economy is of doing it. In other words, even if you agree that a lot of cuts should happen, or cuts of that magnitude should happen, the question is really the sort of phasing in of those cuts.
I think they're also setting themselves up for the cycles of blame that are going to come afterward.
Which
are very predictable this point. You know, we keep kicking these cans down the road, and then after each expiration, you know, after each deadline expires, someone has to be blamed for it. The other thing that your article that you were referring to pointed out was that people are not paying attention to this, which is unfortunate. But people are going to start paying attention as these cuts come through. So at that point, the people will want to know who to blame, and this is President Obama trying to get out in front and kind of lay the groundwork for blaming congressional inaction.
It depends on where you feel it. So they were talking about at the airport, perhaps, that you'd have fewer air traffic controllers. I wasn't sure if that included the TSA folks, but
yeah,
that's a good way to aggravate people, like directly, you know, make them stand in a longer line, delay the flights.
Leave them with a lot of time to call their congressman on their cell phones while they're waiting for the plane.
Text them and be angry. There are, you know, we should remind ourselves, there are two sort of headbutting exercises going on in D.C. right now. It's the sequester, and then there's the confirmation in the Senate of Chuck Hagel, who last night on Jon Stewart had the headline of Hagel with a smear, and a lot of folks didn't get that. Anyway, just thought I... But there are these two, and the most recent thing I, the most recent, he said a lot of people did not understand that. But
it took me a minute.
Hegel with a smear. Schmear.
Schmear.
That Hegel with a schmear.
Schmear, I said it wrong. But, you know, I do think they now, what I read was they now have the votes to confirm Hegel. So then it's just this head-butting exercise. But that.
Until a month from now.
Until a month from now.
Until we get to gun control. Oh. It's not the only headbutting right. exercise that's going to occur in Congress in the next few weeks.
The effort, the headbutting effort, affects us in the Northwest. And Hal Burton had an article on it. We've been asking these questions as well, because people there and Boeing. We heard about Boeing. Everybody's preparing for these cuts, and here in the Northwest, a defense dependent area, we could feel it. Right at a time when our economy was looking kind of rosy for a lot of people.
And rosier, when I should say. The Republicans, all these standoffs are blurring together. But during one of the previous standoffs over the budget and the debt ceiling, the Republicans were saying this creates too much uncertainty. Businesses don't know how to plan for what's coming next. But that is exactly what's being created right now by Republicans refusing to come to the table and talk to President Obama and get something hammered out in the next few days. It's tremendous uncertainty. Big businesses like Boeing, like you're saying, don't even know exactly how this is going to hurt them, but they know it's going to hurt.
So Matt Miller, in his column, tossed out the idea that if Congress wanted to, they could try, because again, you have people opposed to it, they could try to pass a payroll tax cut at the same time as the sequester goes in as a way to offset the impact on the economy. Anybody think that might happen?
The only thing I know about the payroll tax business is that people really, starting in January when the payroll tax holiday, as it was called, became something of a non-holiday and went away, and people felt that. It was noticeable in paychecks. So if they wanted to tie that in, that would be an interesting formula.
All right, we'll take a break, come back. We'll talk about changes in guns in Washington, gun registration politics in Washington State. This is Weekday.
Forty-four degrees in Seattle, heading towards a high today of 48. It's windy and rainy. Forecast says expect it to stay that way through the day with wind gusts up to 40 miles an hour.
Gifts of stock and other appreciated assets are a great way to support KUOW and receive tax advantages at the same time. For information about how to make a gift of securities, contact Matt Albertson at 206-221-2732 or email majorgifts@kuow.org.
Consumer advocate and former presidential candidate Ralph Nader is not impressed with President Obama's recent call to raise the federal minimum wage, saying it's too little, too late. Ralph Nader will tell us what he thinks needs to be done about wages this afternoon at 1.
Support for KUOW comes from the Cornell Queens Executive MBA program, designed for mid-career managers and professionals offering weekend classes in Seattle. Local admissions events March 5th and 7th. Information and event registration at cornellseattle.com.
I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 10:23.
You're listening to Weekday for a Friday, where we review the news of the week with Knut Berger, who is author of Putatopolis and also A History of the Space Needle, Eli Sanders, who is associate editor of The Stranger, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, Joni Balter of the Seattle Times. Before we, we'll go to guns. We'll go to guns, and then we'll talk about Tim Iman and his problems, or no. So, gun rights groups, and particularly Alan Gottlieb of the Citizens Committee for the Right to Keep and Bear Arms, who is a frequent commentator in our state about gun control and background checks and the like. He said Tuesday he would support mandatory background checks for all firearms purchases, if state lawmakers, I love that citizens get to negotiate with their legislators. If state lawmakers agree to end, which is what it's supposed to be, right? And agree to end some, he sees it as a de facto database of handgun owners. You know, that state lawmakers would agree to, you know, not keep the records very long. And boy, he got a lot of attacks from the people who don't support these ideas from his side, saying he'd gone
from the NRA,
NRA and the other constituents.
But this could be a kind of grand bargain Washington State version on gun control if this goes through. It sounds like, from what Jamie Peterson, who is pushing this bill, which is getting some remarkable traction, from what Jamie Peterson was saying, in the media that the so-called database is just records that the state doesn't do anything with anyway. So maybe they can cease to exist and that wouldn't be a problem. And if that would bring gun control opponents on board for universal background checks, that could be a trade worth making. And it could be huge if that passed the legislature. But we are currently, I think, talking about just the House, not the Senate, where Democrat and gun control advocate supposedly Rodney Tom has installed an NRA-approved Republican in charge of the committee that could block any gun control.
May not bring it up.
I thought that the whole point for the state Senate was that they weren't going to go there. So you have this action in the House, and you know this shows exactly how hard gun control is, because I think, if I read correctly, Washington would be the only state to get rid of its registry like that, to get rid of that kind of record. And so that would be unusual, but it shows you have to, you know, this give to get, which Gottlieb was talking about. And so what if that does happen in the House? Then what happens when you get to the Senate, where the committee leader has said, we're not going there, we're not going to do it? So what pressure would be brought to bear? This all happens, as you know, often in the latter days of the legislative session when people are horse trading. You know, I don't want this, you do want that. And you know who's been surprisingly quiet this year so far in all matters legislative is the House Speaker Frank Chop. And he's no lightweight dealer. I mean, he plays tough. So it'll be interesting to see down toward the end, if these things are just sitting there toward the end of the legislative session, which one comes forward, which one says, well, I'm not going to give on something you want over in the Senate unless you put guns up or reproductive parity or something that the other side wants.
And unfortunately, I think we may be seeing how this would play out in the Senate. Gottlieb is willing to compromise, but he's just one leader of one gun rights advocacy organization in Washington state. The NRA doesn't agree with him. And the NRA seems to have in its pocket the chairman of the relevant committee in the Senate. So if the NRA is opposed and this chairman, whose name I keep forgetting, but you probably remember, Steve, or can look up.
I remember nothing, but I will look it up.
this chairman, who is rated with an A-plus rating by the NRA, will probably block it.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, you know, it's hard to imagine anybody sort of getting to the right of Alan Gottlieb on guns. And so it's interesting in that sense. And one of the interesting things here is this. I mean, the NRA used to support universal background checks. So he's actually basically advocating a kind of, you know, the previous NRA position. I think the question isn't, you know, is whether they can give political cover to some pro-gun legislators to talk about the legislation. The Jamie Peterson seems to feel that giving up the database is not giving up a lot, but I think what Gottlieb is thinking is that you know, they don't want to see gun registration, and background checks are there. You know, you can separate that from gun registration because you can check somebody's background, but you don't necessarily keep a list of everybody who actually has a gun. And you know, there's a lot of, you know, fear and paranoia about that data. And I think it's. You know, and he's getting a ton of pushback from his own constituency on even proposing this compromise.
There's a lot of interesting players, because you also have Democrats who will vote against gun control, and you have a Republican who's making a name and aggravating the NRA, Mike Hope, who's for some level of gun control, but he's getting his own pushback.
Mike Hope's an interesting personality in this, because he represents Lake Stevens as a Republican. He's a Seattle police officer. Has he opened a wedge for a conversation to take place among Republicans that otherwise would have been pressured by the NRA, which is very strong, and the other gun rights groups?
Whenever you watch legislation in Olympia, it is interesting to see who will go away from their party expectations and do something unique. So last year during the gay marriage discussion, it seemed, I don't know if it seemed this way to everybody, but it seemed to some people that the gay marriage legislation wouldn't go through. And then you had a couple of senators, Steve Litzow, Cheryl Flug, say at first, pretty early on in January, that, and these are two Republicans, that they were going to not do what was maybe expected of someone in their party, and they were going to vote for gay marriage. And so then things started to move. And I think, you know, because everyone can count the votes if you just count the party of the members. It's when you see somebody or somebody's push away from their party to do something different that you think maybe something would change.
And what creates those moments is not just defectors that start an interesting conversation or quote-unquote defectors like Mr. Hope, but also public pressure. There was huge public pressure leading up to the gay marriage vote in the legislature, and that gets people's attention, and it also gives representatives and senators cover in a way to say this is an incredibly important moment to the people of Washington State, and I have to think long and hard about this and vote my conscience.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Well, it kind of reminds me in some ways of what Obama and Biden are doing at the national level on gun control. They are taking that show on the road, and they are going to talk to, you know, schools and public rallies in the districts of people who are maybe on the fence or they think that they are gettable, you know, who they can get the public by talking and appealing to the public or students or schools or something and have them. It's a go-around-the-guy strategy to get them to pressure the person who's wavering or who won't vote the way that Obama and Biden want them to do.
Does anything seem to be shaking out at the national level in terms of the gun control legislation? It doesn't seem that much more than their roadshow is.
Well, I did see, and I blogged about this the other day on the Slog, the Stranger's blog, that the president of the NRA said that there will be votes and that the NRA would support this. In other words, that the NRA is not going to try to push for a filibuster or some other method of blocking votes on the various gun control measures that are moving forward in Congress. And I think that in and of itself is progress. Obama, you know, as people who watch the State of the Union address will remember, had that very powerful refrain talking about victims of gun violence and saying they deserve a vote. These sensible measures deserve an up and down vote, and if Congress wants to reject them, let the members of Congress get on the record about it. And now the NRA is essentially agreeing with that demand, and so it will be very, very interesting when we finally do get all members of Congress on the record on these issues.
All right. Just real quickly, Tim Iman.
Talkative guy. Talkative.
Talkative. He got in trouble with his own, well, not his own, but with the Republican Party chair, Kirby Wilbur, for calling out Jay Inslee.
He made the Republican Party chair, shall we say, squeamish, who didn't want to be standing quite so close to the comments, which did you say I'm allowed to say on the air?
You could say them if you'd like. I was avoiding saying them.
I'll avoid them.
Well, I won't.
Go ahead. We can all do it together.
Okay. Tim Iman, perhaps wanting a little bit of publicity for an unknown reason.
Tim Iman?
Yeah. Said the other day that our governor was a lying whore, which definitely got a lot of people's attention, and it got the attention of the state Republican Party chairman Kirby Wilbur, who, if you know, he speaks his mind too, and he thought this was shameful and not the right thing to say, and asked for an apology, which I think Tim Iman said no to this morning in a new email in which he. Well, anyway, this is pushing it, but in a new email in which he was sort of backhandedly complimenting the press on their coverage of the Reardon story.
Yeah. And Rob Holland.
And Rob Holland, the port commissioner. And in the same breath, although it was a long breath, I must say, and there may have been no air at all, but anyway, began saying that too bad the press doesn't do this for Jay Inslee.
And what his complaint? His complaint?
His complaint is some of the words that Inslee used during the campaign to describe what he would do if a tax increase came by his, you know, near his desk and stuff, what he would do And so that became the reason to say that he was lying.
I would veto anything that heads the wrong direction, and the wrong direction is new taxes in the state of Washington.
To be fair to Inslee, Inslee did talk. Both he and Rob McKenna spoke of transportation taxes. Rob McKenna, as I recall, was more clear that it would be 2013 or 14 when those taxes would either be discussed or put on the ballot. And Inslee was a little vaguer at the time, but he definitely spoke of transportation taxes.
Yeah, yeah. And that's his complaint. Jay Inslee is talking about a package that the legislature is talking about putting together to do a transportation package.
House Democrats,
yes, excuse me. But I should not equate them all.
In fact, I haven't heard Inslee talking about it. What I read was that Inslee hasn't come forward and said very much at all on the proposal from the House Democrats. And what House Democrats are saying is that this may just have to go straight to the voters. So I'm not sure how I'm in logic is not his strong suit, I guess, or not something that he feels bound to. But this is a proposal that comes not from Jay Inslee, but from House Democrats, and may just end up going to the voters who Tim Iman seems to think are quite wise anyway, and we'll see what they say.
It's also true, you know, Tim Iman has the voters behind him on these two-thirds thresholds for taxes. He has been much less successful when he has tried to get involved in transportation policy. Those initiatives have not fared very well. And this is sort of a blending of the two conversations.
Speaking of that, you mentioned Frank Chopp. I'll come back to him. But where has Governor Inslee been from your analysis compared to Governor Gregoire, or, you know, first few months of a Governor Locke? I know, you know, where has Inslee been?
Well, that's a question a lot of people in Olympia have been asking. I think there's a perception among some in Olympia that he has been slow to do hires in terms of finding department heads and appointees, that he has not put together his own budget, a full budget. He probably won't. Some people, Frank Chopp doesn't think he needs to. Ed Murray has been quoted as saying he should. The legislature is going to do the budget anyway, but I think there, is some restlessness, has been some restlessness. I think it was the Seattle Times had a story on this that was certainly matched things that I had also been hearing from people in Olympia who are not Republicans and, you know, whatnot, people who are, and I think there is a transition that he's going to have to go through. Having been a congressman and a legislator to being an executive and administrator. And that can be a difficult transition both ways. Remember, Dan Evans became a U.S. senator and hated it, but he was a great governor and loved being a governor. And he said, you know, the Senate is just, I don't like that way of doing things. I like to be in charge. So transition that you have to go through. In addition, Inslee is trying to make and is making, I think, some unconventional appointments. He's bringing in business people. He's has had an executive search looking for new blood. We have the appointment this week, a new head of the Department of Transportation, which is a real departure, at least from what I can tell, and that you're bringing in someone from Oregon, who's basically, very oriented toward things like transit and those kinds of things, and not necessarily somebody with the strong sort of road building bias, perhaps. Not anytime you get into transportation policy, there's controversy, but it's interesting that she seems to have a different kind of orientation.
She was with 1,000 Friends of Oregon. You know, she's a highway engineer. She's seems pretty enviro.
Lynn Peterson. Right.
Yes, her name is Lynn Peterson. She's been an advisor to Kitzhaber. She's worked for TriMet. She actually is an engineer, which is interesting, too. So she seems like a very intriguing pick. And, the culture at WashDOT is pretty strong, and they're engaged in some huge sort of highway projects and prospective highway projects. And the one that she has experience working on already is Columbia Crossing, which is the big new Columbia River Bridge project, which Washington and Oregon have to come together on and have not entirely.
But the funds for that would be in the House Democrats' tax increase package that got everybody in such a great mood here.
Right. And I think she's indicated even now that she's supportive of that package, or that, you know, the gas tax and the other increases that would go along. She's sympathetic to that.
Back on the question of where Jay Inslee is, my preference is always for a leader who leads, but you could see how it might seem to Inslee or his people that it's politically smarter to hang back and let the budgeting process move through the legislature, keep a distance from it. Everyone is saying that no matter what anyone proposes, the outcome is going to be unsatisfying this year, just because of the alignment, the political alignment in the legislature. So what does Inslee gain politically by putting a budget out there that's just a pinata for Iman and Republicans in the Senate to swing at, and that binds him? You know, he's already being... people are already trying to catch him in various alleged hypocrisies based on statements he made in the campaign. So a new budget proposal would just be more opportunities for people to do that.
You know, there's something for him to gain from what some would call a soft start. There's a cautiousness to the way he's coming in. He's not coming in and the previous governor, Gregoire, left a budget. And he didn't come in. He certainly didn't say that was his budget, but he's sort of leaving it sitting there from the executive office while the House and the Senate write their own budgets. Maybe he's just trying to figure out the lay of the land. But in general, there's a cautiousness to him. When the Iman comments came up, what did his lead communications person say? No comment. You know, a cautiousness, a carefulness, a sort of a, if you will, a recognition that they're learning the lay of the land down there.
I just wanted to say this week I did a story for Crosscut about Seattle's first newspaper. And one of the funny things in that paper, in 1863, the Seattle Gazette was launched, eventually morphed into what became the PI. What was interesting was in this very first issue of the very first newspaper in Seattle, they talked about coffee, they talked about coal transportation, they talked about rain. I mean, there were all the subjects. And one of the things they talked about was how horrible Olympia was in the legislature and the territorial government. The kind of language Tim Iman used was almost gentle compared to what the 19th century newspapers described politicians. And one of the things they said was, you know, every time they get together in session and come up with something, they produce a hell broth.
Oh, nice.
The public, a hell
We're
broth.
Such wimps now.
I thought the biennial budget is always a hell broth. You know, nobody ever comes away feeling like it tastes good.
I was just watching the pantomime that Jason Pagano was making in the
hell broth
room.
He was eating hell broth.
He was ladling the hell broth, which gets back to the point that I was making before. You don't want to be the person who's perceived by the public as the guy with his hand on the ladle of the hell broth. You want someone else to be ladled.
Somebody else's fingerprints. That's good.
Very nice. All right, before the break, I just wanted to say, since you mentioned Paul Hammond and Department of Transportation folks, Aubrey Davis dying, passing away. He sat in that very chair a number of times talking about transportation, and you all have talked about him with him over the years. But I also thought it was interesting that for him, his work at Group Health was very important in establishing Group Health as an important entity in our state, or helping to strengthen it. So, Aubrey Davis, who lived a long and healthy life, we wish him wealth on his next road, since he was transportation secretary. All right, we'll take a break. This is Weekday.
More news and review in a minute, but first, news of the weather. It's windy, rainy, and 44 degrees in Seattle. Forecast says we should reach a high today of 48, windy and rainy through the day.
Support for KUOW comes from Soaring Heart Natural Bed Company, handcrafted mattresses and bed toppers from locally sourced suppliers for over 30 years. This month featuring signature mattress sets and organic bedding. Location and sleep resources online at SoaringHeart.com.
Growing up in Phoenixville, Pennsylvania, Mike Piazza spent hours and hours hitting baseballs in a homemade batting cage in his backyard.
Sometimes I was hitting 10:30 at night, and with aluminum bat, you know, it could be pretty loud.
Ping.
Yeah, ping, you know, like a tuning fork, you know.
Mike Piazza's noisy path to the major leagues, Saturday and weekend edition from NPR News.
Tomorrow morning, right here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from the City of Seattle, helping to reduce pollution in the Lower Duwamish Waterway by searching out and controlling sources and working with businesses to keep pollutants out of stormwater. More information online at seattle.gov by searching Protect Duwamish.
I'm Bernard Woollett. It's 10:45. U.S. drones in Africa in our next NPR newscast, which is 15 minutes away.
We're reviewing the news on this Friday with Knute Berger, Eli Sanders, Joni Balter. Boy, my voice.
Your voice. You've got about 15 minutes left of that voice. You know that?
I think I'm going away for a while.
Yeah.
You, Knute, covered the mayor's State of the City address?
I did write about it, yes.
Yeah, wrote about it? Yeah. Did you learn anything interesting?
Well, I thought it was really interesting because, in a way, it was an opening framing speech of the mayoral campaign for Mike McGinn. I mean, as unpopular as he has been in the polls and as controversial and whatnot, he, I think, is starting out from painting a picture of a position of strength. I was contrasting it with the State of the City address he gave in 2010, which was just dreadful. I mean, he was sort
off
of
a
speaking.
Napkin or something.
Yeah,
I'm pretty sure.
He wasn't reading the speech. He was kind of talking. There were these awkward pauses. And he basically was giving a very downbeat view. Seattle doesn't like downbeat in general. And the press covered it at the Times, you know, calling, I think Publicola, you know, called it his bummer speech. It was just this, you know, just this big downer of a talk. This was the opposite. One of the interesting things, and I counted, he used the word together or 17 times. He used the partner or partnership another half dozen times. He was giving credit to everybody. You know, the council, to citizens groups, El Centro de la Raza, everywhere he could, he was pointing out organizations and other things. And it was we, together, 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 and laying out how far the city has come since 2009, since he was elected, and basically citing a list of progress and genuine progress in a lot of different areas. He's painting a picture of the economy. Just look at the number of cranes going up, the number of building projects in the pipeline, the number of new apartments and households in the pipeline. You know, Seattle is doing really well nationally. We're number four. Major crime is way down. He's taking some credit for that. Giving with the usual caveats.
You know, in terms of that, here's a little bit from that speech. He was talking about the we part of it, the unprecedented police and community response, he said, brought the murder rate down dramatically in the second half of the year. Here's what McGinn had to say about that.
In the midst of a very difficult period, with the spotlight on policing unlike any in recent decades, they've continued to bring down our crime rate. Compared to year-end 2009, violent crime is down and property crime is down. In fact, overall crime is at a 30-year low.
Did you agree with when Mayor McGinn gave his State of the City speech, he was sort of organizing his campaign for re-election?
Well, I'm not sure about that part, but there is a noticeable difference between the Lone Ranger who took office in 2010 and the person who's speaking here, using those, you know, learning to work with others and bragging about it. A couple things. The murder rate off that is really tough to describe because it's a very peculiar number. And then when you start doing percentages, very, very misleading. So one thing to be careful about is the murder rate. That said, I personally have noticed more bicycle cops in a couple of neighborhoods downtown, Capitol Hill and the University District. I've just seen more. And I don't know if it's just my timing, you know, or if there really are more sort of creating that presence on the street. One thing that and I don't know if this was the way you wrote it, Skip, or exactly what he said, but something about, you know, there will be no highway blotting. Oh, sorry. No highway blotting the waterfront, which that's a funny one for him since, you know, he was so active, at least in opposing the tunnel.
Thoughts on the mayor?
I just want to say, if I wrote it, that's the way it was.
Well, 100% then. You yeah, betcha. So.
There you go. You he betcha. Did. He did take credit. Or,
I'm
well,
not
that's
sure
a funny one then.
I'm not sure what's so unclear about the decline in the murder rate and the 30-year low in crime in Seattle. We talked a lot about the spike in murders on this show that was seen last year and about what it would look like if it continued at that pace for the rest of the year. And whether or not you can say directly who's responsible for it, I think that is a little mystifying and hard to really sort out. But the fact is the number of murders dropped off sharply before the end of the year so that it was lower than the previous year. And any politician is going to point to that as something that's good, even if he can't say exactly what he did that caused that, if anything. And in terms of the togetherness and the kumbaya feeling of his speech, it is either, depending on your perspective, because he was a Lone Ranger or because he got tagged so firmly and repeatedly over years and years and years in office, or 3 years. I guess that is years and years and years, 3 years. because he got tagged as this kind of my way or the highway leader.
Didn't McGinn and Gene Godden join hands and sing Kumbaya at the end of that State of the Speech?
That was the best part.
Yeah.
And then the curtain came down.
Well,
you go.
Yeah, a couple things.
And then you go.
Okay, a couple things. One is, one thing I think McGinn has learned, at least somewhat, is that he used to talk when he was first elected mayor. He talked about he was not apologetic for being tough, and he said, you know, I play pickup basketball and learn how to throw an elbow if I needed to, and he wanted to know people. He would throw an elbow back if he needed to, and I think he's sort of transitioned now to a mayor who realizes he's not Lonnie Shelton. You know, he's not the big guy throwing elbows on the court. He's in the front office. He's running the franchise, and you have to play it differently. And I think he seems to be figuring that out. The second thing about the campaign nature of the speech was that every issue that his opponents are trying to carve out as their issue, he addressed. It was really interesting. Crime. Not only is my chief doing a good job, we're overseeing the police department better. And, you know, all that kind of hotspot, high-tech, sociological crime stuff. I've hired the guys who do that to do that here, okay? That's a check to Tim Burgess. He even talked about the neighborhoods, Peter Steinbrück's strength. And McGinn is saying, gee, you know what? I don't think the neighborhoods, you know, we need to go in there and tell them what to do. We already have neighborhood plans. What we need to do is go ask them what they want to implement. In other words, this isn't the top down, the city telling you what to do. You've already decided what to do, and we're just going to help you implement that. Check Peter Steinbrück. And so there were various points throughout the speech where you could see he was addressing issues his opponents have raised and saying, you know, I've got that.
Very early on in the McGinn administration, I was at an event, and a bunch of the other mayors were there, including Charlie Royer, who was trying, you know, he didn't have this moment with him, or he did, but he
mayor
was
in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah. And he was saying, and he was observing McGinn at the time, and he said, you know, one of his problems was that he had spent much of his life as a litigator, and so that his inclination was to sort of swing first. And Royer was discussing the idea that politics is the art of, you know, there are winners and losers in politics, but it's the art of making everyone feel like they won in a grand bargain or a bargain of some kind. And it seemed to me that Charlie Royer was going to go tell that to the new mayor, but, it's not like I have it on tape or anything, but it sure looked like that would occur. And so those are those kind of lessons, perhaps, that have come up and that people have advised him. The other thing on the crime and the police chief, this was an interesting week in that, because Burgess. So you have the mayor's race in full throttle here, of course. So you had Councilmember Tim Burgess has already said that there would be a new police chief if he's elected. Well, not to be outdone, Bruce Harrell had a thought about police chief using a sort of an old tool to say we, the council, should be reconfirming police chiefs on a regular basis. You know, the council was involved when the mayor picked John Diaz just a few years ago. But so Harrell's saying, wait, we get another vote, basically. This came up once before, if you all recall, with the city light director, Gary Zarker. Somebody found this little known rule that nobody had been paying attention to because folks had been there for a long time. And it was, let's reconfirm. In other words, let's put our stamp. Let's give us a forum on this topic.
Yeah. By the way, the mayor talked about the coal trains, and John Kitzhaber, governor of Oregon, talked about coal trains. They don't seem like they're strange bedfellows to me, but is something emerging here in terms of consensus about whether coal trains should be running along the coast?
Yeah. I certainly, in terms of the urban political leaders in Seattle, McGinn was very clear that he thought the coal train proposal would be a disaster. And once, you know, of course, he wants a full kind of economic impact study because he's saying, you know, the issue isn't just, well, the coal trains, oh, they'll create X number of jobs. But he's arguing, yeah, they're going to destroy X number of jobs with the way that they interrupt transportation, shipping, freight, mobility, et cetera, when you have the kind of high volume of trains coming through. The question that, as McGinn takes a strong anti-coal train stance for the city, Kitzhaber, of course, then the pressure raises on Jay Inslee to sort of say, well, Kitzhaber's against coal trains. Where are you? Why, you know, and he's been very cautious about taking a position sort of, well, I want all the facts.
We need to study an environmental statement.
Exactly. So there's been a lot more sort of sense of caution there. But McGinn was pretty unequivocal about where he stood.
It's a little bizarre, by the way, Inslee's caution on this, given that he made a name for himself, at least before he became our governor, as someone who is very focused on clean energy and the environment.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it goes back to this sort of stay out of trouble kind of approach that they're taking. Don't be too controversial. Let the House Democrats, if they want to raise taxes on transportation, you know, sort of a more passive, like, yeah, I'll let that go by my desk.
For now.
And stay out of the fray on Iman, you know, be above it on that one. And on this one, just kind of just stay and study. It's cautious.
Well, and Democrats always have trouble when the unions and the Greens are at odds on an issue because that splits their part of their coalition.
Their base, huh? The coalition. All right, real quick, I have 2 minutes left. I want to get both things in. First restaurant review. You were doing some research. What was this?
Oh, well, when I was writing about Seattle's first newspaper, I came across what I think has to be like the first restaurant review. It was a small item touting a business called the Fashion Saloon, Seattle, 1863. They had an oyster bar. And they were touted for their coffee and their cake and their fresh or stewed oysters.
Very nice.
Anyway, it was just fun.
If we were ever to get a gift for Canute, it would be a time machine.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Hence
immunity shots.
All right. And secondly, gondolas over downtown? Yes or no?
Sounds like a monorail just revisited kind of thing.
Gondolas?
You know, I kind of like it. I love the idea of the gondola that runs from the top of top of Capitol Hill down Denny to the Sculpture Park. That seems like a great way to get above everything and get somewhere.
What was the campaign for the monorail?
Rise above it all.
Come on.
Be beautiful in the snow. I know we don't get that very often, but gondolas
most
associated with ski mountains, and it would be really pretty when it's snowed here.
Our former colleague, Ken Vincent, gondolas.
Big gondola guy.
He was a big gondola fan.
Yeah, he was.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll see how that goes, that proposal. Canute Berger is the author of Pugetopolis and a book on the history of the Space Needle. Eli Sanders is associate editor, The Stranger, and Joni Balters with the Seattle Times. Thank you all.
Thank you. Happy weekend.
Thank you, Steve.
Talk to you guys again in a few weeks. I'll be gone nursing my cold. No, I'll be doing other things. Bernard Ouellette's our engineer. Weekdays produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, Amin Al-Saadi, Andy Hurst, Danielle Anthony Goodwin, our intern. We'll talk to you folks in a few weeks. This is Weekday.
10:59. Two people were killed today in Oklahoma City when a medical helicopter crashed. More in the news in a minute. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from Rotary Club of Des Moines, presenting the 9th Annual Poverty Bay Wine Festival, March 1st through the 3rd at the Landmark on the Sound Event Center in Des Moines. Live music, local food vendors, and wine from over 25 Washington State wineries. More information at dmrotary.org.
I'm Bob Garfield, and on this week's On the Media, a man who went from town to town persuading parents to pay to put their kids in a movie that he made over and over again.
My favorite aspect to his personality that I've been able to discover is that he actually hated children. He loved dogs.
Also, one of the civil rights movement's greatest photographers was an FBI informant. On this week's On the Media from WNYC.
Sunday night at 6 o'clock on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.